dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. We will be going about a bit of the battle space of the war for the free world, as I like to think of it here. Over the next hour, we will be visited by several really extraordinary people, starting with our first guest, Ryan Morrow, who is now a national security analyst with RadicalIslam.org. He is the author of Death to America, The Unreported Battle of Iraq. Ryan, you are also frequently in print in a variety of other places, including the Front Page magazine, and you've recently written about an operation that has not gotten very much attention, I don't think. Tell us about Holy Islamville in South Carolina and what you've been doing to try to call attention to it.
This is a compound run by a radical Islamic group called Muslims of the Americas, which the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security says is linked to Jamaat al-Fukra, which is a Pakistani militant group that, in the words of the State Department, is an Islamic sect that seeks to purify Islam through violence. And so they run this place in York County, South Carolina, called Holy Islamville. It's about 36 acres large. It's a private community, and we do have recordings of gunfire coming out of there. The neighbors have reported explosions coming out of there. And so this is a very scary place where they indoctrinate the people living there, and has ties to, you know, very radical groups, a Pakistani militant group, like I said. Yet when I was briefing about 10 South Carolina legislators the other week about this, as well as some political activists, almost no one knew that it existed.
Am I correct that this is reasonably closely located to a nuclear power plant down in that neck of the woods?
That is true. And by the way, we do know that this camp is part of a network of other camps around the country, of which there are at least 22 of what they call villages, where they engage in paramilitary training. I received a secret tape that belonged to this group that showed that at their headquarters in New York State, a place called Islamburg, their women were dressed in military fatigue, shooting guns into a lake and simulating how to carry out ambushes.
And I guess the reason I ask about the nuclear power plant is it seems as though, from my small exposure to this Jamaat al-Fukra group and its American operations, many of them are located in proximity to strategic targets, whether they're military bases, armories, dams, power plants, what have you. Tell us a little bit about Sheikh Jalani, the cult-like leader of this operation. What has he said is his purpose with respect to this Jamaat al-Fukra network of camps that, as you say, Ryan Morrow, are seemingly in the business of preparing for, at a minimum, some kind of violent activity?
Well, they practiced a lot of violence in the past. Jamaat al-Fukra, Sheikh Jalani's, that's the Pakistani branch of Sheikh Jalani's operation, has been tied to at least 17 acts of terrorism on U.S. soil since the late 1970s. And Sheikh Jalani and his followers believe that he is a representative of God, that is, he is second only to Muhammad, and that he can carry out all sorts of miracles, that he transforms into animals and is watching them at all times. And so they really follow him, like you said, as a cult leader. And so he's radical even compared to what other radicals believe. And he's viciously anti-Semitic. He says things like Jews are examples of human Satans, the Jews were behind 9/11, the Jews control the U.S. government. And so he gives Muslims every reason to believe that the U.S. government is an enemy waging war on Islam.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they don't need much encouragement to believe that in any event. But to the extent that this is being done under our noses and in ways that that signal certainly to the immediately adjacent community that there's automatic weapons training and training in explosives and that sort of thing. What is the FBI doing about these sorts of threats internal to the United States, if anything, Ryan Morrow?
Well, there are reports out there, and I believe them, that they conduct surveillance of these groups. I would imagine that they're doing that, but that isn't enough, because surveillance doesn't stop these groups from indoctrinating their children. Surveillance doesn't stop them from training people in paramilitary tactics. And surveillance doesn't enable them to watch everything that's going on inside of all the private homes on these compounds spread around the country. And because this group, Jamaat al-Fukra, is not designated as a foreign terrorist organization, law enforcement has to say these guys are American citizens that own private property, and there's nothing that we can do about it. And I've had counterterrorism officials tell me that, you know, this just isn't sexy enough for most people. If you arrest a member of al-Qaeda or Hamas, that's good for your career. But when it comes to Jamaat al-Fukra, no one knows who it is, and that's not really a big boon to your career.
Boy, this is very worrying. Ryan Morrow, I'm delighted you're covering it, and I appreciate you bringing it to our attention here at Secure Freedom Radio. One of the things that's so vexing is if you are looking at this sort of threat in the making, it may not be sexy until it erupts on you, but boy, when it does, there will be all kinds of finger-pointing and blame being passed around. But at that point, it will be too late, probably, for some people. You have also done recently, Ryan Morrow, an interview with a character that I have interviewed here as well, by the name of Anjum Chowdhury. Remind us who Anjum Chowdhury is, and what was your takeaway from the conversation you had with him?
Well, Anjum Chowdhury stands out because he's really so honest about his objectives. He has publicly hailed the 9/11 hijackers. He hails Osama bin Laden. So he doesn't run around parading himself as a moderate. He says what he believes, and he's an effective speaker who knows how to make it sound like he's coming from a good place, even though he isn't. And so it's a remarkable interview because he details why he believes the creation of an Islamic State over all of the earth, which is his goal and the goal of his colleagues, is a good thing. And one of the things that really struck out to me, and I said this on Fox News, is I said to him, all the leadership of al-Qaeda is being decimated in these drone strikes. What gives you hope? And he said the ongoing attacks on U.S. forces in Afghanistan, the fact that the U.S. is negotiating with the Taliban in Afghanistan, and the fact that we've established a timeline for withdrawal.
Right. These are the sorts of things that I believe the more you know about this British jihadist, a sort of rabble-rouser, really, in the United Kingdom, the more troubling it is that he is allowed to operate with impunity. Ryan Morrow's interview with Anjum Chowdhury is at worldthreats.com, and as you mentioned, he will find at that site the clip from his recent appearance on the 2nd of May at Fox News. When you talk with a guy like Anjum Chowdhury, Ryan Morrow, and when he explains very pointedly what he is about in terms of trying to impose Sharia on Britain and create no-go zones inside British cities and otherwise advance the agenda of this, well, it's essentially the same agenda, isn't it, as al-Qaeda. Isn't it striking to you that guys, well, like the Jamaat al-Fukra folks, that guys like this are allowed to operate with impunity in Western nations?
It's disturbing but not surprising, because if I was a jihadist, I would look at these same openings in Western culture, Western democracy, and say, why aren't we taking advantage of it? What does shock me is the lack of reaction from the societies of the West as a whole to people like this. I mean, no, like I said, most people in South Carolina did not know, still do not know, that Holy Islamville even exists in their territory, and it scares me to think what it's going to take for the American people to wake up.
Ryan Morrow, we've only got a minute left, but you're also trying to raise awareness about this, as are we, with our effort at MuslimBrotherhoodInAmerica.com. Tell us quickly about the Best Buy Boycott initiative that you've launched. What's that about?
Over at RadicalIslam.org, we have started a petition for people to pledge to boycott Best Buy until they stop financially supporting CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, which your listeners know is a Muslim Brotherhood front set up to support Hamas. The Best Buy have contributed to a fundraiser for CARE in Minnesota, and so we reacted with a boycott, and amazingly, we have over 10,000 signatures, and so it was really encouraging to see Americans around the country step up to this task.
Good. Well, we will be following it with great interest. It's unbelievable that any corporation in the country, let alone one that is as prominent as Best Buy, would be supporting, would not want to even be seen with, let alone enabling, a Muslim Brotherhood front like the Council on American Islamic Relations. Keep up the good work. Ryan Morrow at radicalislam.org and worldthreats.com. And keep coming back to us, if you will. It's always great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Next up, we'll be talking with Congressman Alan West, getting his take on, among other things, the deal President Obama has now struck with, well, not yet the Taliban, but the Afghan government, soon to be the Taliban, perhaps. Straight ahead.
First line of defense in the war of ideas. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy. Eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Well, it's a high privilege to be able to welcome back one of our most favored guests, member of Congress, former Lieutenant Colonel, United States Army, decorated combat veteran, remarkable man, Alan West, now representing the people of the state of Florida in the United States House of Representatives and serving with distinction on, among other things, the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman West, it is always a privilege, as I say, to have you with us, and especially at a time when there's a lot of stuff that really needs the kind of clarity that you tend to bring to national security issues. So I'm really glad to have you with us.
Well, Frank, you know, you can call on me anytime. And I think that, you know, even though we have to be concerned about our economic security and energy security, we can never lose our eye and lose the bubble on our national security.
Amen. Let's talk a little bit about some pieces of it that may be slipping out of the eye's sight at the moment. The State Department, I think, since we last visited, made some comment to the effect in the form of an unnamed senior official, mind you, but something to the effect that the war on terror is over and we've got drone strikes even today that have taken down apparently a couple more al-Qaeda guys in Yemen. Give us your reading on the state of the war, what we used to at least call the war on terror, at the moment, and where we're going from here, do you think?
Well, first of all, in response to the drone attack that you saw in Yemen, al-Qaeda there in Yemen already attacked a Yemeni military base. They killed 20 Yemeni soldiers and they took 25 hostage. So I don't think that this thing is anywhere near being over. As a matter of fact, you saw within 90 minutes after the president departing Afghanistan, the Taliban launched an attack right there in Kabul that killed seven and I think wounded another seven to nine individuals. So again, you know, we cannot, you know, focus this thing down so narrowly to say we're just fighting al-Qaeda or the Taliban or it's a war on terrorism, which is just a tactic. You really have to understand that this is a fight against radical Islamic fundamentalism and actually totalitarianism. And, you know, you have to look at that full spectrum of this, which, of course, you study and you understand very well the civilizational type of jihad and the infiltration of Syria into Western civilization. So it's all those things we must come to understand. And my concern, and I'm sure you share the same thing, is that it's not just the trigger-pulling war or combat that we are engaged in. It's the conflagration that happens behind the scenes, whereby all of a sudden we've got the FBI having to whitewash their training manuals and materials. We have the same with the Department of Defense. You have a Fort Hood report on the Major Malik Nadal Hassan shooting, which makes no reference to his relationship with Anwar al-Awlaki or talks about jihadism or Islamic extremism or terrorism. So it's those type of very stealthy ways, as you say, stealth jihad, which is also part of this 21st century battlefield that we have to pay attention to.
Yeah, and Alan West, as you understand so well, as a guy who's actually been in the trigger-pulling business, if we lose sight of what we're saying to the enemy by acts of submission, whether it's, you know, the rules of engagement on the battlefield or whether it's this kind of penetration that is tolerated here, it only redoubles the resolve of the enemy and increases the threat.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's one of those forms of maneuver that we call an envelopment and actually becomes a double envelopment because you're engaged in a hot war, but you're also engaged in a cold war. And you have to pay attention to that. You have to understand the linkage between the two. You know, it's very simple. As we've talked about before, you go back and you read that 1991 exploratory memorandum that was found here in Northern Virginia during the FBI raid, and it lays out exactly the plans of infiltration into the operating systems of this country. But yet and still, we have to be focused on fighting the hot war that is there with these, you know, the multiple Islamic terrorist groups that are out there.
Right, and seem to be growing by the day. Alan West, one of the things that has been in the news lately, most especially because, of course, President Obama made a kind of, well, I think of it as a whistle-stop campaign appearance in Afghanistan to sign and obviously vector attention towards the 10-year security agreement with the Afghans. Does that give you confidence that, in fact, we're going to maintain the kind of pressure on the enemy there that we've felt necessary to this point? Or are we, in fact, really just trying to paper over the impending surrender of the place to the Taliban?
Yeah, I think that right now no one is really sure, Frank. I look at what happened between President Obama and President Karzai as a 1930s Chamberlain-Hitler moment. And there is not going to be peace in our time. And when, you know, the president makes his speech and he talks about negotiation with the Taliban, well, as we said, less than 90 minutes after his departure, he got the response from the Taliban as far as these negotiations. So again, you know, you cannot have a peaceful situation, a stable environment in Afghanistan unless you deal with the enemy sanctuaries in Pakistan. And I think that we need to have a strategic sense that moves us toward counterterrorism and not counterinsurgency and certainly not nation building. We don't need to dump any more money into Afghanistan to help them build their systems. Let, you know, go to other members of the world community and let them do that. What we need to make sure is that this radical Islamic terrorist enemy fundamentalist enemy is not allowed to have sanctuary anywhere where he can train, recruit, pull in his resources, and so he can launch attacks. That's the most important thing that we need to focus on. And what I am concerned about is that we are starting to look at the commander-in-chief in the White House as more of a tactical battlefield operator, which, if you recall, going back to Vietnam, when Lyndon Johnson was approving bombing targets out of the White House, that didn't work out so well. We need to have a true national security strategy.
Yeah. Over the weekend, as you may know, Congressman Alan West, former Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, General Jack Keane, made a rather striking announcement, and that was that to his certain knowledge, President Obama was aware of the location of Osama bin Laden the summer before the May attack.
Summer 2010. Yeah,
and it suggests that he was unable or unwilling to, speaking of pulling the trigger, pull the trigger on the SEAL raid that took bin Laden out for months. And General Keane made the observation, which I'm sure as a combat trained soldier yourself, you would fully appreciate, the guy could have slipped away had he at any point in that 10 months of apparently dithering gotten wind of the fact that he was under surveillance.
Absolutely.
What does that tell you about this this commander-in-chief that we ought to know as we're thinking about re-upping him?
When you hesitate, you lose the opportunities, and the window of opportunity with someone such as Osama bin Laden was definitely very fleeting. And as far as General Jack Keane, I mean, his integrity, his character is beyond reproach, and so I don't think anyone should question him on that. And, you know, Frank, I found it very interesting, the ad that was run, you know, Bill Clinton was part of that ad to, you know, here we are, have a former president whose military prowess was so, you know, impeccable that he approved bombing a milk factory in Africa. He approved bombing a desert sands in Afghanistan and also the Chinese embassy in Serbia. So
and he let Osama bin Laden get away a couple of times.
And he let Osama bin Laden get away. So that's about
irony of ironies.
Yeah, zero credibility there. So I mean, and it was very shocking that no one brought that up as far as that ad. So, you know, again, I think that the truth may end up coming out about, you know, how that decision was made. Of course, you know, Vice President Joe Biden has, you know, come out and said that he voted against, you know, launching that operation. So, you know, we don't know what really happened behind closed doors, but there are some people that said much the same with the shooting of the Somali pirates to rescue the Maersk captain, that it was the commander on the Bainbridge that made that call and not anyone out of the White House that did that. So we'll have to see how this plays out later.
Yeah. And Attorney General Michael Mukasey, former Attorney General now, made the point that there seemed to be a paper trail in place that in case it did go bad, the president would be able to fob off responsibility on Admiral McRaven. So this is not his finest hour.
And see, Frank, that is the essence of what we have to understand. Leaders take responsibility. They don't take credit.
There you go. Well said, sir. As always, we're always delighted to be joined by you. Congressman Alan West of Florida, thank you for the leadership that you're currently providing, often without credit, but always with great effect in the Congress of the United States, and for your service to our country in your previous capacity in uniform. God bless you, sir, and come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, best of luck.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Next up, we will be speaking with Susan Yoshihara about what is going on with the demography as destiny. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, a fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Have you ever asked yourself why, despite more than 10 years of efforts involving thousands lost in combat, over $1 trillion spent, countless man years wasted in airport security lines, and endless efforts to avoid offending seemingly permanently aggrieved Muslim activists, we are no closer to victory in the so-called war on terror than we were on 9/11. Thankfully, we have been able to kill some dangerous bad guys. But the sad truth of the matter is that by almost any other measure, the prospect of victory is becoming more remote by the day, and no one seems able to explain the reason. Until now. Check out the Center for Security Policy's new, free, 10-part internet video course called The Muslim Brotherhood in America, The Enemy Within, at www.muslimbrotherhoodinamerica.com. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by a remarkable woman. Susan Yoshihara is her name. She is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, a veteran of the Navy as a helicopter pilot, a Ph.D. in international relations, a professor at the Naval War College, now as a senior vice president for research and the director of the International Organizations Research Group. She is the co-editor of Population Decline and the Remaking of Great Power Politics. Susan, congratulations on this really important new work addressing a subject that I think most of us don't pay any attention to at all. Give us in the shortest of form, if you would, what you're getting at in terms of kind of demographics is destiny, if I can call it that.
Thank you. It's good to be on your show. You know, for decades, scholars have told us that if there were fewer of us born on this planet, the world would be a lot safer. And I just wanted to investigate that question, and it turns out that the opposite is true. Demographic decline in the next 20, 30 years is about to make the world a whole lot more unstable. And this book explores the great powers, Europe, United States, Russia, China, India, and Japan, and looks at ways that scholars haven't unearthed before how it's going to be a lot more unstable because of fertility and population decline.
And instability arising from population declines is primarily a function of others moving into those countries and taking over where the native population has simply ceased to reproduce at adequate rates? Is it that countries find themselves going to war over resources when they think new opportunities exist for that kind of thing? Or again, tease that out for us, if you would.
There could be a few ways that instability could come about. As you said, it could be outright war. For example, for many years we've heard that resource competition because of population increase could cause war. And in the same case, you might see the great powers going to war because they are now going to be changing their pecking order. We see that as a less likely scenario. The instability we see are coming from a few different things. For example, in Japan, it's going to be the pulling back of Japan. Japan has a very robust agenda for international help, aid, sending ships to the wars, for example, committing to UN funding, etc. But they're going to lose 30% of their population by 2060. They're going to plummet down to 86 million from 127 million. And they're just not going to be able to do it. So there's what we call a strategy policy mismatch here. Ambitious countries, Europe, who want to do things like peacekeeping, who want to be world leaders in things like norms and international institutions. But, you know, things like the debt crisis there are driven by demographics. So demographics are going to be destabilizing in these economic and political ways. They're also going to be, I think, destabilizing in military ways. For example, the alliance. If you look at the alliance now, I think the United States is wise to make a strategic pivot to Asia, but it has to be backed up. It has to be backed up with a strategy that specifically looks at some of these more strategic issues and, of course, with assets. And, of course, the United States is facing a big budget crunch here and huge defense slashes that I don't think take account of what the U.S. has in hand, and that's its own demographic exceptionalism. So,
this really
is
a critical point, because one of the things that we're being told, Susan Yoshihara is our guest, the co-editor of a new book, Population Decline and the Remaking of Great Power Politics. One of the things we're being told, Susan, is that we will be able safely to reduce our defense spending and investment in military capabilities because we will be able to rely increasingly on our allies to pick up the slack. And what you're describing here suggests that anything but is likely to be the case.
No, you're right. And we've come to the opposite conclusion. You know, when you look at the world, you look at what's going to happen to Japan. Here's our number one friend and ally in the region. And they have had to scale back drastically. I mean, they're already retiring new ships early. Because they don't have enough young sailors. They have frontline troops that are already too old on average to man units according to American standards. And I don't think we've taken account of how Europe is going to be pulling back as well. And, you know, then you look at the rising powers. You know, China, we see China on the rise. I know you're going to have Gordon on later. But China has already announced a contraction in its workforce. And I think that what we see there as a destabilizing trend is that China might see the windows closing sooner than they expected on manpower-intensive military operations. That's destabilizing. And in Russia, they've already lowered the nuclear threshold because of population decline. I mean, they've in the last two security strategies, they've already said, look, we've got to maybe fire them off sooner than we expected. And tactical nukes have already become the backstop to lack of troops on the Russian Far East. So, when you start piecing these together, all of these case studies together, I think what you see is it's going to be a lot, the burden is going to shift to the United States. In other words, it's going to be a lot more unstable, but the United States is really going to be the only one that's going to be able to rally enough forces. And I'm worried just because we're facing this perhaps an automatic defense cut coming up, and a lot of this is not in the discussion. It's really budget driven. The recent fiscal cut on. I know this chairman of the Joint Chiefs has already sort of hashed this out in the press with the GOP leaders, but it is really budget-driven, and that's a great concern.
Yeah, it certainly is. Susan Yoshihara, let me ask you two things, because I want to cover them before we run out of time. We will be speaking with Gordon Chang, one of your contributors, about the China bit, which you alluded to a moment ago in our next segment. But before we have to let you go, talk to me about the exceptionalism of the United States with respect to these demographic trends as you see it. And if you would, let's also talk about the role that Islamic birth rates have been playing, or at least until recently have been playing, in both offsetting the decline of population in Europe, but changing the character of the population, the demographics in Europe.
Well, we'll start with the U.S., and the U.S. alone among citizens of the developed world are having enough children to replace themselves. The magic number is 2,100 children per 1,000 women. So the shorthand is 2.1 children per woman as a replacement for developed countries. And the United States had that all the way up to the recession in 2008. And then it stayed at about 2 children on average. And when you look at the numbers, it's the decline has come from young women. Teen pregnancy is down. Women in their 20s and having a second or third children, which tells us that women are sort of waiting to see how the recession pans out. And if there's an upturn, I think we'll be right back to a robust replacement rate. No other country has that. Even France, Sweden, and the UK, who have worked so hard with, you know, baby bonuses and child care, et cetera, have not been able to get it back up to replacement.
And so, Susan, that is not a function of the Hispanic contribution to the high birth rate?
No, it's not. It's not just immigration. Now, immigration has played a part of it, although I have to say, looking at the numbers, that population you talked about has declined the most sharply since 2008. So we're going to be relying more on, I guess, on what we call native-born. But no, the replacement rate for Anglos, I guess, so European descent women here in the United States is higher than it is for our countries across the pond.
And quickly, talk to us about the Islamist or the Islamic population weapon, as they often say in Sharia circles.
Yeah, you know, in this book, we've just uncovered so many conventional wisdoms, and so many times the conventional wisdom is not what you'd think. In places like Iran, the population has plummeted faster than anywhere else on Earth. It's gone from almost 6 children to less than 2 children in one generation. And that's causing these destabilizing echo booms. So an echo boom means you might have, you know, a lower fertility, but you've got all these women, a huge cohort, having only 2 children, and that's they've closed down schools and services. I had an Iranian delegate at the UN tell me this is just what's happening, and now they have overcrowding of classrooms and overcrowding, et cetera. And that's a real problem in some of these countries, and that's going to happen.
And how about this population in Europe, very quickly?
Well, very quickly. So, yes, the immigrant population tends to be much higher. It's changing the character, especially in places like France. We don't know what the numbers are because they don't keep track. But then after a while, these immigrants tend to take on the fertility patterns of their home countries. So that's not going to be a way out for Europe either.
Susan, we are going to have you back because there's so much to explore here with you. Susan Yoshihara is our guest. She has let me just make sure I get the title right. It's a long one. You are at the Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute, where you serve as the Senior Vice President for Research and the Director of International Organizations Research Group, and she is the co-editor of Population Decline and the Remaking of Great Power Politics. Thank you for your past service to our country. Susan, thank you for this service, and we look forward to visiting with you again soon. Next up, as promised, we will have Gordon Chang on to talk a bit more about the Chinese piece of this demographic phenomenon and much more straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show. Welcome to the morning and out to school. Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as promised by Gordon Chang, our duty expert on Asia, also the man who Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com, Fox News.com, and the broadcast network all use for that purpose as well. Gordon, you are, as we mentioned in the previous segment with Susan Yoshihara, a contributor to her new book about population decline. In the interest of covering as much of the rest of the world as we could, we saved our conversation about what's been happening in China in this regard for our time with you. We've talked about it from time to time in recent weeks, especially against the backdrop of sort of the drama that Chen Guangcheng has brought to much attention, specifically with respect to the one-child policy. But give us the essence, if you would, Gordon, of your chapter in this new book and your thinking about where China's demography leads it at the moment.
Most everyone says that China owns this century. But if you look at demography, and that's really important because it defines what is possible, China is not going to own this period of history. For one thing, China is going to level off. The population will level off about 2025, maybe as even early as 2020. By the middle of this century, India will at least have 500 million more people than China, maybe 600 million more people. But even more important, the Chinese workforce will start to level off next year, 2016 at the latest, probably at the front end of that range because of the acceleration of population trends in China. And then the workforce will decline. That'll be very difficult because soon one worker will support two parents and four grandparents. China will be very, very old before it gets rich, as they say. And India will have at least 200 million more workers, maybe double the size of the Chinese workforce towards the latter part of this century.
Yeah. I think Susan alluded to the fact that China has already begun to sort of recalculate the kind of workforce that it will be able to marshal in light of these trends. But this is a tremendously important point, Gordon, that you've just made with respect to, you know, the dependence of generation upon generation on a dwindling number of the young, the working age population. I guess this is true in spades in Japan as well, isn't it?
Yeah, Japan is a very interesting case because it is getting smaller. It'll probably be, and I forget the exact numbers, but it'll be like about 30, 35 million people smaller within about 40, 45 years. This is a spectacular decline in the Japanese population, and it's important for us because Japan is our cornerstone in Asia, as they say. And whether it'll be able to field an important military to help us is really a big question because they just won't have the people.
Yeah, and Susan really made that point quite dramatically, I think, in talking about warships that are being retired because they can't be manned. People of a considerably advanced age now in the armed forces of Japan. And it really comes against the backdrop of this notion that we're able safely to cut our national security investments, we're told, because the Allies will pick up the slack. Certainly doesn't seem to be true in Japan. And from what she was saying earlier, Gordon Chang, it doesn't seem like it's likely out of Europe either. Let me drill down on something I guess we've talked about with you both in our regular segments and on an irregular basis, thankfully, namely this drama involving Chen Guangcheng, the dissident, blind dissident, of whom I spoke a moment ago. What's the latest on that, Gordon, now that the so-called strategic dialogue involving senior American officials is over? Is he basically now abandoned to his fate?
Chen right now is in a Chinese hospital getting treatment for his leg because he fell down a number of times escaping from his home in Shandong province. And he'll be in the hospital for a little while. He has been asking really to leave China and go to the United States to study. He doesn't want to come here permanently. He wants to get a degree and then go back because he wants to be an agent for change in China. This was a instance of very poor diplomacy on our part. We did some very good things in the sense of negotiating the four assurances that the Chinese government gave, But we abandoned Chen in the hospital last week, and we shouldn't have done that. We should have had our diplomats there with him so that he could not be interfered with. And so, unfortunately, what we have is a situation where we could have done a little bit more and gotten so much more in return, and certainly helped the Chinese people and the human rights situation in China.
Gordon, I'm a little confused about all this because I get what you've said, obviously, but the solution that seems to now be held out is that he will be given some kind of visa to come to the United States to study. I'm unaware of students, generally at least, being allowed to bring their family along when they come to study. And hasn't his concern, you know, that induced him to leave the embassy in the first place been about his family and how they've been treated? And do we know their present condition, let alone what might happen to them in terms of getting out of the country?
It appears that the deal that has informally been worked out with Beijing is that Chen, his wife, and two children will be allowed to come to the United States. But as you point out, his mother and brother are back in Shandong. They have been threatened. And it's not just Chen's family, immediate or otherwise. It's really the whole network of activists who helped Chen get from Shandong province to Beijing, and they have really been, that network's been rolled up. China has not been as difficult as it might otherwise have been, but nonetheless, those people are at risk, and especially those people will be at risk when the international spotlight moves from Chen to something else. And so
that's what worries me.
Yeah, the United States really needs to protect not only the Chen family, but also that whole underground railway, which is so vital in helping dissidents and activists.
Hard to do when you've given up such leverage as you had. Tell us what we got, if anything, in return for allaying some of the Chinese apprehensions about this business by, you know, essentially getting him off the embassy grounds. With respect to this strategic dialogue, Gordon Chang.
Yeah, the strategic and economic dialogue, which was held Thursday and Friday, produced really very, very little. There were a lot of promises, but almost no concrete action. The only thing that seems to have come out of it is a promise by China to permit foreigners to increase their participation in joint venture security companies from 20% to 49%. And while that's welcome, that's hardly major news. And certainly, when you think about all the effort that we put into the SED, as it's called, it was very meager outcome. These talks, which have been going on since 2006, have produced very, very little. And it's time for us to rethink our diplomacy that, you know, sometimes maybe we can accomplish more by talking less. And this whole apparatus that we have gotten ourselves into really is not very productive.
Yeah, especially this idea of bringing hundreds of people along to essentially, it seems, kowtow to Beijing is bad all the way around, it seems to me, Gordon Chang. Anything on the technology transfer issue that you're aware of? I know that was something we were closely following earlier.
As part of the SED, there has been a thought about negotiating an investment treaty, allowing the Chinese more investment into U.S. companies, which is not a good thing. And also, there's been some vague promises on the part of the Obama administration to relax technology restrictions. But that very well may not happen if the Pentagon gets its way. So there is some vague thought that we might do something more to loosen the restrictions. But here again, I don't know if anything is going to happen in the near future. This is something we need to pay attention to, because if we pay attention, it won't happen. And if it won't happen, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Gordon Chang, last question. Speaking of the Pentagon, the Chinese defense minister is over there. Talk about strategic dialogues that lead to nothing. We've been chasing the will of the wisp of military-to-military relations and dialogue and so on. Anything likely to come out of this visit?
Well, yes, the Chinese are going to get even more know-how from the United States. The defense minister is on a six-day visit to the United States, which includes a number of defense installations. We give much more to the Chinese than we get in return. We need to rethink this because we chase after them to give them stuff, which just makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, well, it neither is conducive to them actually collaborating, I'm afraid, or consistent with our national security interests to protect such information. Gordon Chang, as always, it's great to talk with you. Thank you for visiting with us, and congratulations on your new publication in Susan Yoshihara's book, and as always, for your contributions at Forbes.com and elsewhere. Join us again next week, and I hope the rest of you will do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.